Hey, it's Alan, and I just wanted to let you know that you can now listen to the ongoing history of New Music early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Who doesn't love getting something for free? Labor Day deals have arrived at the Home Depot, and right now you can get a free Milwaukee 18-volt extended capacity battery, $159 value, when you buy a select tool. Get longer runtime and more battery life so you can power all your fall projects. Shop Labor Day deals and get a free battery when you buy a select tool at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. Limit one per transaction. Exclusions apply. Full eligible tool list in store and online.
We get it. Distractions happen. That's why we designed the fully electric, full-sized Volvo EX90 with the latest technology to keep you and those around you safe. Its two-sensor driver understanding system is designed to prevent distractions and help you stay focused. Reserve your Volvo EX90 today. Learn more at volvocars.com/US.
Hi, I'm Alan Cross, and for the next few weeks of the podcast, we're going to dive deep into the ongoing history archives. There are more than 1,000 shows in there, and many of these programs have not been heard for years. So, welcome to an ongoing History of New Music Archives podcast with a series called The Top 100 Moments in New Rock. Now, bear in mind that these shows originally aired in the spring of 2004, but we thought it might be fun to hear where we've been, how things used to be, and how much everything has changed since. We hope you enjoy this look back in time.
This is the sound of history.
Yeah, one journalist put it very well, said U2's music is for the head, the heart, and for the feet.
Ramones kind of signifies unity or family, brother, gang, brotherhood, all that crap. So here we are, the Ramones.
Clash has got a job on in trying to attempt its ridiculous aims. You know, I'm proud that we've got ridiculous aims because at least we ain't going to underachieve.
This is another special project of the ongoing history of new music, the 100 greatest new rock moments ever. Part 7.
This is the ongoing history of new music podcast with Alan Cross.
Hello again, I'm Alan Cross, and welcome to episode 7 of a 10-part series that examines the 100 most important moments in the history of new rock. Some historians call these moments hinge points, because everything that happened next hinged on the outcome of that one moment. The course of history was altered in some way by this particular event, and sometimes it's not until many years after the fact that we realize that this was a really big deal. Take what happened in the Sunda Strait in Indonesia at 2 minutes after 10 on the morning of August 27th, 1883. The island of Krakatoa was vaporized by this gigantic volcanic explosion. You may have heard all the trivia associated with this eruption, that at least 36,000 people were killed, that it was heard almost 5,000 kilometers away, that the shockwave traveled around the globe 7 times, that sea waves generated by the explosion reached Africa in about 12 hours. But it was only later that we began to realize that Krakatoa had other effects. You know how we often hear about the cold weather records that date back to the middle 1880s? That's because of all the ash from Krakatoa blocked out a significant amount of sunlight, cooling the average global temperature by more than a full degree, and things didn't recover until about 5 years later. Or how about this? You know Edvard Munch's famous painting called The Scream? You want to know what that dude was actually screaming about? Look at the blood-red sky. Munch created that painting after taking a stroll in his village near Oslo, Norway in late 1883. He painted the sky red because it was. And it was all because of the dust from the Krakatoa eruption. But here's my favorite. Author Simon Winchester, someone who has studied the aftermath of Krakatoa, believes that this cataclysmic event led to the Dutch abandoning their colonial rule in Indonesia, leaving the natives to suddenly fend for themselves. The locals turned to radical Islam for comfort, which in turn led to a wave of anti-Western militancy that continues to this day. So, Krakatoa inspired Al-Qaeda? Could be. All right. We're up now to moment number 40, which isn't on the scale of an island disappearing, but some violence did erupt. The dates were June 18th and 19th, 1977. Less than a week earlier, June 11th, the Sex Pistols' God Save the Queen reached number 2 on the British charts. This was the summer of the Queen's Silver Jubilee, and there were many monarchist supporters who didn't take kindly to the Pistols calling their queen a moron. On the evening of the 18th, Johnny Rotten, Pistols producer Chris Thomas, and engineer Bill Price were attacked by a gang armed with razors in the parking lot of London's Pegasus Hotel. And it was a vicious attack. Johnny maintains that the only thing that saved him from bleeding to death was his thick leather pants. As it was, some tendons were cut in his arm, which has forever made it difficult for him to play the guitar. The following night, drummer Paul Cook was attacked outside a pub by 6 guys with pipes. He ended up with 15 stitches in the head. New rock moment number 40. 2 Pistols nearly killed by monarchists. The nights of June 18th and 19th, 1977.
My personal view on punk rock is that it's nauseating, disgusting, degrading, ghastly, sleazy, prurient, voyeuristic, and generally nauseating. I think that just about covers it, as far as I'm concerned. I think most of these groups would be vastly improved by sudden death. The worst of the punk rock groups, I suppose, currently are the Sex Pistols. They are unbelievably nauseating. They are the antithesis of humankind. I would like to see somebody dig a very, very large, exceedingly deep hole and drop the whole bloody lot down it. You know, I think the whole world would be vastly improved by their total and utter non-existence.
New rock moment number 40, the near fatal beating of 2 Sex Pistols and their producer and their engineer in response to the release of God Save the Queen in June of 1977. Moment number 39 involves the time REM drummer Bill Berry nearly died while on tour. It was May 1989. REM was on tour in support of their Green album and had reached Germany. It was their first time in that part of Europe in 4 years, and the band was really looking forward to a string of shows. The first gig in Dusseldorf on May 9th went well enough, and from there was on to Munich. But within hours of arriving in Munich, Bill Berry began to feel really, really sick. He was rushed to the hospital where doctors thought it might be bronchitis. But then the rash started, so someone suggested measles. But then Bill started having hallucinations and drifting in and out of consciousness. That's when the doctors started with a huge buffet of antibiotics, hoping to treat what they assumed to be some kind of viral infection. Still, the doctors had no idea of what the problem actually was. Fortunately for Bill, it just so happened that in their panic to treat him, one of the doctors prescribed tetracycline. It did the trick, but no one knew how or why. When the German doctors called over to Athens, Georgia, to speak to Bill's doctor, he correctly diagnosed the condition as Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever. Not exactly the kind of thing that shows up in Germany a lot. Apparently, Bill had been bitten by a tick while gardening at home a week earlier. This fever has a week-long incubation period, so it didn't set in until REM was already in Germany. And had one of the doctors not blindly prescribed tetracycline, Bill might have very well have died.
So stand in the place where you live. Now face no more. Think about direction. Wonder why you haven't. Now stand in the place where you were. Now face no more. Think about the place where you live. Wonder why.
Bill Berry's near fatal bug bite. New rock moment number 39. And we're going to stay with Bill for moment number 38. This time it was March 1st, 1995, at a stop on the Monster Tour in Lausanne, Switzerland. 90 minutes into the set, and just as the band was about to launch into the falsetto portion of a song called Tongue, Bill was hit with a headache so intense that he described it as if somebody had dropped a bowling ball on his skull. The pain was so severe that he actually had to be carried from the stage. At first, doctors thought it was just a bad migraine brought on by stress and the high altitude of the Swiss Alps. But then a CAT scan revealed 2 potentially fatal brain aneurysms. Bill was rushed in for emergency brain surgery, and he spent 8 long weeks recovering. No one knew if he'd be able to speak again or remember anything. Brain damage was a real possibility. Rock moment number 38. Bill Berry's brain explodes on stage in Switzerland, March 1st, 1995. And that episode, combined with the Rocky Mountain spotted fever scare 6 years earlier, both played a big part in Bill's decision to retire from music on October 30th, 1997. Moment number 37 occurred on April 15th, 1994. A struggling punk band from Orange County released their new album on the indie Epitaph label. Now, it came out with little fanfare, and at first, the only people who picked up on it were skateboarders and snowboarders. Through sheer fluke, the first single was picked up by an LA radio station, which was pretty cool because that almost never happened to Epitaph bands. But then the song spread to a few other radio stations. And that was even weirder. This got Epitaph thinking about doing a video. So the label dug deep and pulled out $5,000 and told the Offspring to shoot something, anything. And they did. And then out of the blue, MTV started playing it. And that's when all hell broke loose. An album that was expected to sell 60,000 copies over its lifetime was suddenly selling that number every couple of days. And when all the dust finally cleared, the Offspring had sold over 12 million copies of Smash, making it the biggest-selling independent record of all time.
You gotta keep them separated.
Hey! Man, you're disrespecting me. Take them out.
You gotta keep them separated.
Hey!
The Offspring release Smash, the biggest-selling indie album ever, April 15th, 1994, and it's New Rock Moment number 37. When we come back, we'll go back to the 60s for what might have been the most important talent discovery in the history of alternative rock.
There are some things that are too good to keep a secret, like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notify, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
We get it. Distractions happen. That's why we designed the fully electric, full-sized Volvo EX90 with the latest technology to keep you and those around you safe. Its two-sensor driver understanding system is designed to prevent distractions and help you stay focused. Reserve your Volvo EX90 today. Learn more at volvocars.com/US.
Allstate wants to remind fans that mayhem is everywhere. Like when your fantasy league meets up at your house. Everything's great until the hot plate gets too hot for the tablecloth. Now your kitchen's up in smoke. And if you don't have the right home insurance coverage, the cost to fix this is anything but a fantasy. So switch to Allstate, save money, and get protected from mayhem like this. Not available in every state. Based on coverage selected, subject to terms, conditions, and availability. Savings vary.
Welcome back. I'm Alan Cross, and this is part 7 of our 10-part look at the 100 greatest moments in new rock. Moment number 36 dates back to December 1965. A new and very weird group called the Velvet Underground had just got their first regular gig at a club called Cafe Bazaar in Greenwich Village, New York City. They were commissioned to play 6 sets a night, 6 nights a week, at $5 per set. Unfortunately for the owner, the band's music tended to chase away patrons instead of luring them in, and the band was fired at least once for driving away customers. But then one night, just before they were to be fired for the second time, Andy Warhol and his entourage of groupies and weirdos dropped in. He was so impressed by the Velvet Underground's avant-garde approach to rock that he immediately signed them to be his official house band at his performance art headquarters called The Factory on East 47th Street, where he became their patron, their producer, and their promoter. The Velvets accepted, and their long, strange road to becoming legends as the first alternative rock band in history had begun. But had Warhol and his crew not dropped in that night, the Velvets would have been inevitably fired again. And who knows where we might be today when it comes to new rock.
Oh, pardon me, sir. It's furthest from my mind. I'm just looking forward to different in my mind.
Andy Warhol adopts the Velvet Underground, thereby giving the band the break they needed to eventually be hailed as the founders of alternative rock. That's New Rock Moment number 36. Moment number 35 was hugely traumatic for fans of the Smashing Pumpkins, and in retrospect, it was the real beginning of the end for the band. The problems began within 6 weeks of the start of the Pumpkins' 1996 world tour. In February, drummer Jimmy Chamberlin and touring keyboardist Jonathan Melvoin OD'd on heroin in Thailand. In May, they OD'd in Spain and almost died. Then came the events of July 1996. After the OD in Thailand, Jimmy promised the band that it was an isolated incident that would never, ever, ever happen again. After the OD in Spain, Jonathan Melvoin was actually fired, but he had to stay with the band until the Pumpkins finished the rest of their tour. Meanwhile, Jimmy was on double secret probation. Do it again and you're fired, dude. I mean, we mean it this time. On July 11th, 1996, just before the Pumpkins were to play two sold-out shows at Madison Square Garden in New York, which, of course, is every band's dream, Jimmy and Jonathan left the hotel and went down to a seedy part of the East Village to score some smack, and they bought a very potent type of heroin known on the street as red rum. By 4 o'clock the next morning, Jonathan, who, by the way, was trained as an emergency medical technician, was dead, an overdose. Jimmy woke from his stupor, called the cops, and within hours, everybody was down at the precinct giving statements. 5 days later, Billy, James, and Darcy of the Pumpkins issued this statement. Today, we are very sorry to tell you that we have decided to sever our relationship with our friend and drummer Jimmy Chamberlin. This may come as a shock to some, to others not, but to us, it is devastating. For 9 years, we have battled with Jimmy's struggles with the insidious disease of drug and alcohol addiction. It nearly destroyed everything we are and stand for. We have decided to carry on without him, and we wish him the best that we have to offer. We would like to thank everyone for their well wishes and support in this very tragic week. Jimmy was exiled from the Pumpkins for 3 years, during which time the Pumpkins' fortunes began to slide. In an attempt to get things back on track, Jimmy was approached to rejoin the band, and on April 10th, 1999, at St. Andrews Hall in Detroit, the Pumpkins appeared in their familiar form for the first time since July 1996. Jimmy Chamberlin, fired from the Smashing Pumpkins for drug use. New Rock Moment number 35. Our 34th moment on the list came about by accident. Here's where we run into one of those strange quirks of fate. Another one of those, you know, seemingly innocent things that ends up changing the course of music history. New Order hated doing encores. So one day they came up with the idea of just turning on Stephen Morris's drum machine and then just letting it go while everyone walked off stage. That way they could get backstage and start drinking before anybody noticed they were gone. And then, for a little bit of spice and to keep the audience at least a little bit interested, they got a sequencer to trigger something on Gillian Welch's keyboards. Then Barney Sumner came up with the idea of sequencing in one of Peter Hook's bass lines, and before they knew it, New Order had the foundations of a new song. And it was all being played entirely by machines. Oh, and there's more. Legend has it that New Order took this idea into the studio one day, loaded up on LSD. They managed to get all the tracks down, but they were so wasted that once they were done, the studio engineer just sent them to the cafe across the street so they could finish mixing the song in peace. When the song was finished, it was released only as an 8-minute, 12-inch single. It got some play on the radio, but it made its biggest impact in the dance clubs. At the time, people were dancing to songs like Physical by Olivia Newton-John and I Love Rock and Roll by Joan Jett. No one had ever heard anything quite like New Order. The impact of Blue Monday was staggering. It forged all kinds of links between new music and rock and dance music. And for many people, this was the song that made dancing cool again. Now think about what that means. Now think about all the groups that started making music like this after this song came out. Blue Monday sold over 3 million copies and is still the best-selling 12-inch record in the history of planet Earth. And it all happened because New Order wanted to get off stage and to start partying as soon as possible. And by the way, The artwork and the cover for the 12-inch was so expensive to produce that New Order lost 1 pence on each copy sold. So, New Order and their record company actually managed to lose 30,000 pounds by issuing the world's favorite dance record. It's all part of New Rock Moment number 34. When we come back to finish this episode, we'll cover an epic first gig, an epic battle, and a coup d'etat.
It's time to get the sleep you deserve with Sleep Number. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, during Sleep Number's biggest sale of the year, you can save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed. Plus, get special financing for a limited time. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com. See store for details. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards.
Sweet Tarts dared to combine sweet and tart. But we didn't stop there. We combined soft and bouncy to bring you new Sweet Tarts Gummies Fruity Splits, a uniquely delicious dual-sided gummy with one side that's sweet and one side that's tart, but entirely smooth and squishy. Mmm, a powerfully perfect combo. Sweet Tarts, dare to combine.
Hi there, I'm Alan Cross, and you're listening to the Top 100 Moments in New Rock, and we're up to moment number 33. In the spring of 1993, no one knew anything about this band from Manchester called Oasis. But that was all about to change. Noel Gallagher had just been fired from his job as a guitar roadie with the Inspiral Carpets and was down to his last £2,000 in severance pay. However, he was determined to turn this cash into a proper music career for himself. Noel was impressed by what his baby brother Liam had done with his band, but Noel thought he could do better. "I will join your group," he said, "but you have to let me be in charge of everything." It was, for all intents and purposes, a coup d'etat. But then came the real victory. On Sunday, May 31st, 1993, Oasis literally bullied their way on stage for a set at King Tut's Wawa Hut in Glasgow, Scotland. They weren't scheduled to play that night. They had just hitched a ride with another Manchester group, a group called 18 Wheeler, and once they got to the club, they threatened the owner and the bouncers. "Let us play or burn the club down," or something to that effect. By coincidence, one of the few people in the audience that night was Alan McGee of Creation Records. He was there to see the other bands on the bill, but he was so impressed with the boys from Manchester, the Oasis boys, that he decided more or less on the spot to sign them up.
Do you remember the night that Alan McGee met you at King Tut's Wawa Hut?
Vividly. Yep. He was wearing a blue top and white jeans and black loafers and ginger hair and sunglasses. And he came up to me and he said, "What are your band called?" And I said, "They're called Oasis." And he said, "Have you got a record deal?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Do you want one?" So I said, "Yeah." And the next day we went back to Manchester, gave him a ring and said, "Are you serious?" And he said, "Yeah." Went down to see him in London. Managed to borrow £1,000 off him that day, blagging him that we needed some equipment. Went back and spent it all. And got a lawyer, hammered out a deal, found a manager, signed the deal. The rest is history.
The first thing McGee did was release a simple 12-inch single pressed up with a plain white label. McGee slipped it to a variety of people within the industry, hoping to drum up some hype. And that worked just fine. And within less than a year, Oasis was on their way to becoming one of the biggest British bands of the 90s, and for a time, one of the biggest bands in the world. And all because they bullied their way on stage at King Tut's Wawa Hut that Sunday night in May of 1993. Here's the famous white label demo of Columbia. New Rock Moment number 33. Oasis gets their way at King Tut's Wawa Hut and launches a career. Moment number 32 also involves Oasis. The release of their second album was hyped up because of an issue the band was having with Blur. This was much more than a rivalry. This was a war. Britpop's two biggest stars going at each other's throats. The two bands first crossed paths at a radio station in San Francisco, and there was almost a fight in the studio. Then Liam and Damon Albarn almost got into a brawl backstage at an award ceremony. Then Damon annoyed Noel by moving up the release date of the new Blur single to coincide with the release of the new Oasis single. The date was August 14th, 1995. In one corner, it was Oasis and Roll With It. In the other, it was Blur and Country House. And all of Britain went crazy over this battle. All the music papers, all the magazines, all the daily papers. Bookies took bets on which single would end up at number one. Even the normally boring BBC had reporters on the story. When they were released, Roll With It and Country House accounted for almost 30% of all the singles sold in the UK that week. And in the end, the winner was Blur. They sold more records in the first week, 270,000 copies to 220,000 for Oasis. But you know how? See, Blur released two versions of Country House, each with a CD containing different bonus tracks. So, if you were a Blur fan and you wanted all these songs, you had to buy both copies of the Country House CD. And if you bought both copies, what did that do to the sales figures? Clever, huh? The Blur vs. Oasis record war at the height of Britpop in August of 1995. That's New Rock Moment number 32. Our final event dates back exactly 21 years from the Blur vs. Oasis thing. It was Wednesday, August 14th, 1974. That night, a new band called the Ramones played their first ever show at a New York club called CBGB. There were less than a dozen people in the bar, including the owner's dog. But by the end of 1974, the Ramones had played CBGB 74 times, and with each gig, the buzz got bigger. The club was soon crammed. Andy Warhol's bunch, stuffy intellectual types, rich uptown kids who wanted to slum it, and music fans who were bored with music and were looking for something new and exciting. It's hard to describe how different the Ramones were in that fall of 1974. Here were the four brothers, all dressed in torn jeans and leather jackets, playing what amounted to bubblegum pop songs, like we used to hear in the 1960s, but playing them at a million miles an hour. There were no solos, no stage patter, no acknowledgement of the audience, no letting up. The only breaks came when Johnny counted off the next song. It was the beginning of the New York punk rock revolution. And here's a tiny slice of what it sounded like that night. The Ramones, first ever show, CBGB, August 14th, 1974. The Ramones and their first show at CBGB, New Rock Moment number 31. Let's do a quick summary of episode 7 of the top 100 moments in New Rock. At number 40, it's Monarchists beating up some Sex Pistols in retaliation for the release of God Save the Queen. At 39 and 38, it's REM drummer Bill Berry's health problems, his Rocky Mountain spotted fever, and his brain aneurysm. Number 37 is the release of Smash by The Offspring, the biggest selling indie album of all time. 36 is the discovery of the Velvet Underground by Andy Warhol. Our 35th moment is the firing of Jimmy Chamberlain from the Smashing Pumpkins. At 34, it's New Order's release of Blue Monday. 33 is the famous story of how Oasis got signed by threatening to burn down a club. 32 is the Blur versus Oasis battle in the summer of 1995. And our 31st moment is the Ramones' debut at CBGB in New York. On episode 8, we'll cover a move to an apartment above a car repair shop in Germany, a famous audition using a jukebox, and the technology that saved music in the 1980s, as well as a business decision that changed music in the 1990s. Be sure to go back to previous episodes in the series to hear what's happened so far on our list of the top 100 moments in New Rock history. If you want more like this, there are hundreds of ongoing History of New Music podcasts available for free. All the platforms have them. Make sure you follow and like the feed so you never miss an episode. Plus, if you can rate and review, that'd be great. We can all meet up on my social media channels. There's my website, ajournalofmusicalthings.com, which is updated every day. Plus, there's the free newsletter that goes with it. And I have another podcast. It looks at the intersection of music and true crime. Look for Uncharted, Crime and Mayhem in the Music Industry, wherever you get your podcasts. And I welcome any emails. Just drop me a line at alan@alancross.ca. Technical production is by Rob Johnston. We'll talk to you next time. I'm Alan Cross.